and shuttered the windows. Surprisingly, he slept well. Not a single nightmare. As soon as he woke, Poe knew they were in for another glorious spring day. He boiled an egg, walked Edgar, then waited for the team to arrive. Reed had walked over from the side of the road and got there first. Flynn and Bradshaw arrived on the quad moments later. Bradshaw shouted with delight when she saw Edgar.
"You didn't tell me you had a dog, Poe," she squealed.
For the next 10 minutes, work was forgotten as Bradshaw and Edgar became best friends. The spaniel, who'd always been an attention junkie, made a beeline for her and lathered her in licks and dog hair. Bradshaw shrieked with laughter and hung her arms around his neck as if afraid he'd run off. Poe passed Tilly some treats to give Edgar, and their friendship was cemented.
"Remember, Tilly, if he shows you his lipstick, don't touch it," Reed said, winking at Poe.
Bradshaw buried her head in the spaniel's neck.
"You don't have any lipstick, do you, Edgar? What a silly goose D.S. Reed is. He must mean your penis."
After they'd laughed at Reed's open-mouthed look of astonishment, Flynn called them to order.
"You can play with Edgar later, Tilly. We need to crack on."
Poe had opened all the windows, and spring sunlight beamed into the room. The ground floor of Herdwick Croft was rectangular, without fancy nooks and crannies. 2 windows at the front, none at the back, and 1 door. Poe explained that years ago, during bad winters, the shepherd lived upstairs while the sheep sheltered in the room they were in now. It offered them protection from the cold and warmed the building. The walls were the same on the inside as they were on the outside, exposed, roughly quartered stone. The ceiling beams were old and sturdy, and black after a century of smoke. A wood-burning stove dominated the room. It had wood inside, but hadn't been lit yet. Despite the warm day, Poe would light it later. It was how he heated his water. Poe put a pot of coffee in the center of the table, and they got to work. As it was his line of inquiry, Flynn let him lead the first session.
"Back to basics, everyone. I want us to assume these men did know each other at some point. They may be hiding that fact, but that's what we detectives do. We detect things."
Bradshaw stuck her hand in the air. Poe waited, but she said nothing. He looked at her, confused, until he remembered that, up until a year ago, her entire life had been spent in classrooms and lecture halls.
"Tilly, you don't have to put your hand up. What is it?"
"I'm not a detective, Poe. I'm an employee of the National Crime Agency, but I don't have the power of arrest like you, Detective Sergeant Reed and Detective Inspector Stephanie Flynn."
Thanks for clearing that up, Tilly. Good to know."
Bradshaw nodded. For the next 4 hours, they delved into the lives and deaths of Graham Russell, Joe Lowell, and Michael James. At midday, Reed took a phone call.
"We have a name for victim number 4.
Clement Owens, 67 years old, retired solicitor, worked in the private sector and represented the banking industry. Apart from his wealth, there's no obvious connection to the others. We'll have more info soon." Flynn called a break. They were all getting hungry, and she'd brought sandwiches with her. Poe suggested they ate outside. Although Poe enjoyed the harsh beauty of a Cumbrian winter, he'd lived at Shap for over a year now, and felt qualified to say that spring was his favourite season. Other than the omnipresent sheep, winter stripped the fells of life, left acres and acres of bitter, colourless landscape for as far as the eyes could see. Spring seemed like resurrection. The days were longer, dormant plants pushed green shoots through the warming earth, and the heather blossomed. Exotic gardens of lichen and moss burst into life. Ferocious, freezing winds became warm, richly scented breezes. Birds nested, animals bred, and there was a renewed sense of optimism in the air. It was the time of year that made you appreciate the beauty and slower pace of life in rural Cumbria. While Flynn was off making a phone call, and Bradshaw chased Edgar all over Shap Fell, Poe turned to Reed and said,
"It's good to see you again, Killian.
How long's it been?
5 years, Reed grunted through a mouthful of ham and egg.
5 years? It can't be. The last time I saw you was my mother's funeral, he said, accusingly.
A burst of blood coloured Poe's cheeks. Reed's mother had died of motor neurone disease after years of illness. He was right. The funeral had been the last time Poe had seen him.
I'm sorry, mate, he said, but Reed waved away his apology.
How's your dad keeping? Asked Poe.
You know him, Poe. He only retired because Mum told him he had to. Still does a bit for a stable in Lancashire. Not even sure they pay him. He does it to fill his time. If he's not doing that, he's napping in front of the fire or reading books on racing.
Reed's father had been a highly respected vet specializing in racehorses. As a boy, Poe had loved visiting George Reed's veterinary practice. There were always animals to fuss over.
How's your dad? Reed asked, smiling. Still a beatnik?
Poe smiled. It wasn't far from the truth. His father lived to travel, and rarely came back to the UK. The only time he'd lived in one place for any length of time was when he was raising Poe. His mother, unable to handle the vanilla life, had abandoned them both when he was a toddler. His father had temporarily sacrificed his nomadic spirit and brought him up alone. As soon as Poe joined the Black Watch, he was off again. They kept in touch via email, but they hadn't seen each other for almost 3 years. As far as Poe knew, his father was in Brazil somewhere. Doing what, he had no idea. He could be deep in the rainforest or running for political office. There really was no way to tell. He loved him dearly, but he'd never been what you'd call a traditional parent. Poe's mother had died a few weeks after he'd been suspended, killed by a hit-and-run driver. He'd only found out when his father emailed him 5 weeks after she'd been cremated. He'd been saddened by her death, just as he was saddened by anyone's death, but he hadn't lingered on it. She'd made a choice to put her own needs before his a long time ago.
"You seeing anyone?" Reed asked.
Poe shook his head. He'd always found it hard forming relationships. When he'd been down in Hampshire, there'd been a few women, but nothing that lasted for more than a few weeks. A therapist might have told him it was because he had a deep-seated fear of abandonment, but Poe would have told them they were wrong. He wasn't scared of abandonment. It was all he'd ever known.
"You?" he asked.
"Nothing permanent."
"Well, aren't we a pair of romantic bastards?" Poe smiled.
Flynn returned from her phone call.
"I've just spoken to Director Van Zyl," she said. "He wants us to stay up here for as long as it takes. I told him about our new line of inquiry, and he agrees it's worth pursuing."
She sat down, poured herself a coffee, and grabbed a sandwich. She looked tired, and Poe knew the investigation was getting to her. None of it made sense, especially his connection. And Eskass was supposed to answer questions, not pose them. The sun was bright, and the view as stunning as always. Uneven ground, treeless hills and jagged rocks for miles in every direction. Edgar tried to beg Flynn's crusts, but unlike Bradshaw, who'd given him virtually all her lunch, she seemed immune to the sad-eyed puppy-dog routine. When he realized the treats were over, Edgar wandered off, and before long there was a screech. A curlew panicked into the air. Edgar reappeared, looking pleased with himself.
"Leave the birds alone, Edgar!"
Poe shouted, before he could find the ground nest. The last thing he needed was the spaniel coming back to Bradshaw with a mouthful of hatchlings. Edgar reluctantly returned to the croft. Flynn brushed some crumbs from her jacket. She was wearing the suit she'd had on the first day she'd been there, the one with the pinstripes. Bradshaw was wearing her usual cargo pants and T-shirt. Reed was immaculately dressed. He'd always been a clothes horse and never dressed casually. Even when they'd socialized together, Reed wore a suit, and Poe suspected he'd considered his own lack of effort a burden and disgrace. Poe was still wearing the clothes he had on yesterday, which reminded him his mail was still unopened in his pocket. He retrieved the bundle and glanced through it. There was a letter from his gas supplier letting him know that the delivery time for his fresh tank had been changed, and one from the borehole pump suppliers telling him his warranty had expired. If he wanted to renew it, it would be £6 a month. Poe didn't. The last envelope was plain brown. His name was typed on the front, and the postmark was local. He slid a knife under the flap and slit it open. He shook out the contents. It was a postcard. A generic picture of a cup of coffee. The foam on top had been fashioned into a design by someone with too much time on their hands. Latte art, he thought it was called. Something they did in London, not Cumbria. He flipped it over. He must have let out a gasp as Flynn, Reed, and Bradshaw all turned to stare.
"What is it, Poe?" Flynn asked.
He turned the card so they could all see what was written on the back. One symbol, two words. A question mark, reversed. A percentation point. And Washington Poe.
Chapter 14.
"What the hell?"
Flynn muttered. She turned to stare at Poe.
"What is this?"
Poe didn't take his eyes from the postcard.
"I have absolutely no idea," he managed.
It was clear no one else did either. The only sound that could be heard was Edgar gnawing on a bone he'd found. No one wanted to know where he'd got it from.
"And what the hell's that reverse question mark thing?" Flynn added.
She placed the envelope and postcard into a clear evidence bag while Reed called Gamble to let him know. He promised to get someone across to take it for a forensic test, although none of them was holding out hope. The immolation man didn't make mistakes at chaotic crime scenes. He was hardly likely to make one when he wasn't in a hurry. Bradshaw scanned both sides through the evidence bag so they had an electronic copy. She stared at her tablet for almost 10 minutes, occasionally touching the screen and pulling her fingers apart to zoom in on something. She started to frown and mutter to herself.
"What is it, Tilly?" asked Flynn. "I need to go inside," she replied.
She got up without another word. By the time they caught up with her, she had her laptop open. She was searching for something. She turned to Poe and said,
"Do you have a white bedsheet you can hang on the wall, Poe?"
He did, and luckily it was clean. Reed helped him put it up, while Bradshaw set up the projector she'd brought with her. When they'd finished, Bradshaw was ready. She aimed the light at the hanging sheet. She moved to Google's homepage and typed in percentation point. Nothing happened, and she apologized for the slow internet connection. A picture came up. It was the same symbol, the reverse question mark. Underneath was the definition. The percentation point, sometimes called the snark or the irony mark, is a little-known notation used to indicate that the sentence is to be taken rhetorically, ironically, or as sarcasm. It can also be used to indicate that there is another layer of meaning in a sentence.
"Tilly," Flynn said, "where are you going with—"
"Let her speak, boss," Poe said. "I think I know."
Bradshaw looked at him gratefully.
"Thank you, Poe. The point I'm trying to make, D.I. Stephanie Flynn, is, if I do this—"
She fiddled with the projector until it was out of focus.
"What does the percentation point look like?"
Poe squinted, although he already knew. He watched Flynn to see if she could see it as well.
"It looks like a number 5, she said.
Bradshaw nodded excitedly.
"We'd assume the killer had carved a number 5 into the chest of Michael James. But what if that was simply apophenia, which means—" "We know what apophenia means, Tilly," Flynn said. "Seeing patterns when there aren't any," Bradshaw finished regardless. "What if we saw the number 5 because we're conditioned to look for numbers? And my program works on probability. It wouldn't have recognized the percentation point, so would have simply inserted the nearest thing to it."
"The number 5, Poe said.
"Yes, Poe," she replied. "The number 5 would be the nearest match to the program's reference points. The letter S would have been the closest after that."
"Is there any way to check the original wounds?" Poe asked.
"Yes, Poe. I still have the data on my laptop."
She pressed a few buttons on her laptop,
and the 3D image of his name appeared on the wall. It was the clearest one of his name. The letters were all taken from different slides to ensure each one was the optimum for viewing. "Can you separate the symbol?" Poe asked. In his mind, he'd already dismissed the number 5. Bradshaw fiddled some more. There were 50 images of the symbol, each one taken at a slightly different depth. She put them on a slideshow, shallowest first. Because of the damage caused by the burnt flesh, the first few did look like the number 5. The deeper she went with the image, the clearer the cuts became. The last few weren't clear at all, just some nicks in the breastbone. She came back up a couple of slides. "There," Reed said. "That's the one." Bradshaw stopped the slideshow. They stared at the screen. What they'd earlier assumed had been the bottom part of the number 5 was in fact a separate, albeit smaller, wound. The immolation man had added a single stab wound under the curved part of the percutation point to represent the dot. Probably stabbed, then twisted to add depth and definition. When the fire caused the flesh to split, the wound at the bottom had taken the path of least resistance and joined the bottom of the percutation point. While the top MSCT images had looked like a number 5, the lower ones most certainly didn't. It wasn't a perfect explanation, but Poe suspected that the immolation man, when trying to carve an elegant and obscure symbol into the chest of a wriggling, screaming victim, had simply done the best he could. And because everyone had missed it, he'd followed it up with a postcard. If they were right, and Poe thought they were, then he wasn't the intended fifth victim. That was good news. The bad news was that the immolation man knew where he lived. He said, "Well, boss, I don't know about you, but if I had to put my money on it, I'd say that wasn't a number 5 after all. I'd say that was a perforation point."
"Percutation point," Bradshaw corrected.
"Agreed," Flynn said. "It's too much of a coincidence not to be."
Poe felt a prickle of excitement. Bradshaw had said one of the percutation point's uses was to denote that a sentence or passage had another layer or meaning. He picked up the evidence bag.
"Do we all think this was sent because we didn't get the first message?"
Flynn paused.
"There's nothing else we can think."
"And there was definitely nothing on the first two victims?" he asked.
"Nope,"
Reed replied.
"They've been retrospectively checked."
"And Eskas were called in after the second victim, but after the post-mortem."
Flynn nodded.
"So, it would be fair to say, if you did have a message for Eskas, the body of the third victim, rather than the first, would be the one to use."
"Logically, I can't argue with that," Flynn said. "What do we need to do next?"
"I think we should look at Michael James's chest again," Poe said. "All the slides, not just the highlights. But this time, we put on our lateral thinking pants."
Bradshaw's hand shot up.
"Our figurative lateral thinking pants," Poe said, without missing a beat.
Her hand went back down.
Bradshaw brought up the 3D image of Poe's name, and they all studied it. Reed said,
"That the only one we have, Tilly?"
As before, she took them through a series of slides. The last one was a deeper image and showed fragments of the wounds used to make up the letters in Washington Poe. These were the wounds that had cut so deep they'd caught the ribs. Most of the others hadn't gone as deep. None of the other images seemed to offer up anything new, and she returned to the first one. For 5 minutes, no one spoke as they absorbed what was projected onto Poe's wall. Tilly opened as many screens as she could fit on the sheet and filled them with different pictures.
"Anyone?"
Flynn asked.
Poe was staring so hard his eyes were beginning to blur. Like the percutation point, the top images were the most distorted by the fire. The edges of the wounds weren't as sharp as the ones taken from deeper inside the body. Bradshaw brought up some more. The new images were different to the ones they'd been viewing previously. The fire hadn't managed to get that deep, and the wounds Bradshaw was showing on the sheet were sharper, thin, and precise. Poe leaned in, squinted at one of the images, and said, Is it just me, or do those letters look different?
Bradshaw responded first.
You're right, Poe. The slant of the letters isn't consistent. Neither is the spacing.
She produced a laser pointer from nowhere and aimed it at the sheet.
I've studied forensic handwriting, and I think the second, third, and fourth letter in Washington and the first letter in Poe were written left-handed. The difference in the spacing would also suggest they were written before the right-handed letters were put in.
Poe said,
Steph, this is your investigation. What do you think?
She stood and walked to the makeshift screen. She traced the four letters with her hand. She turned and said,
I think you're both right. I think those four letters are different, and I think they do mean something. Unfortunately, they are of no help whatsoever.
Chapter 15 Poe felt deflated. He waited for Flynn's explanation.
It's an anagram, she said.
Poe had never been good at word puzzles. He was a lateral rather than analytical thinker. Reed was even worse than he was, which, for someone with his vocabulary, was surprising. Bradshaw could probably solve anagrams at the same time as she solved advanced equations, but even he could have a decent stab at a four-letter problem. Flynn didn't give him time to think.
It's Shap, she said. That's why the letters were different. It was to make sure we came to this Washington Poe.
Poe immediately reflated. He knew something Flynn didn't. He and Reed exchanged glances. He said,
You ever Googled yourself, Steph?
She blushed slightly and said she hadn't.
Yeah, you have, he thought. Everyone has.
Poe was as don't-give-a-shit-what-people-think as they came, and he'd Googled himself. When Peyton Williams had died, and someone, almost certainly Deputy Director Hansen, had leaked his name to the press, he'd stayed off the internet while the press called him a vigilante. In truth, it had been an easy thing to do. By then he'd been suspended and was living at Herdwick Croft, where surfing the net to idle away time was no longer possible. But curiosity is a funny thing. One evening, he'd been in the bar at Shapwell's, and, taking advantage of the free Wi-Fi, he typed his name into Google, the first time he'd done it. The results were astonishing. The vitriol aimed his way was bizarre. Peyton Williams had abducted and killed two women, had almost killed a third, and yet, in some people's eyes, Poe was the bad guy. He remembered the good old days when having strong opinions about issues you knew nothing about was considered a negative thing. Facts no longer mattered. Populism and fake news had seemingly turned half the population into mindless trolls. But the other thing he'd learned from searching Google was that he shared his name with only one other person, an American politician from Georgia who had died in 1876. He was sure there must be others out there, but he doubted Gamble would have needed his name and location to work out to which Washington Poe the immolation man was referring. He could imagine the detectives in Cumbria, some of whom he'd worked with for years, saying, Oh, that's Washington Poe. Now he's mentioned Shap, I know exactly who he means. He explained that there were no other Washington Poes, but Flynn didn't seem convinced.
It's too much of a coincidence, she said. And the immolation man wouldn't necessarily know there's only one of you on the internet.
Poe shrugged.
I think it's worth following up. If he hid Shap in the message just to make sure you came to me, then fair enough. But checking costs us nothing.
He waited for her to make the right decision. She didn't disappoint. She nodded and turned to Reed.
I think this might be a job for our liaison officer. Can you get onto Cumbria's intelligence systems, see if anything weird has happened here recently?
Like? JDLR, Poe cut in. You'll know it when you see it.
Just doesn't look right, Reed said.
Okay, I'll go to Kendall Nick and check Sleuth.
Sleuth was Cumbria Police's intelligence system. Any intelligence, whether it was criminal behavior or not, would be recorded there. Reed said he'd also ring Gamble to brief him on where they were.
After he'd left, Poe said to Bradshaw, "While he's away, Tilly, can you have a look and see what you can dig up?"
"Can I go back to the hotel, Poe? The Wi-Fi is stronger there."
"I'll give you a lift, unless you want me to show you how to drive the quad."
Bradshaw looked at Flynn in excitement.
"Can I, D.I. Stephanie Flynn? Please, please!"
"Can she?"
Flynn asked Poe.
"Makes sense," he replied. "We don't know how long we're going to be up here, and we all need to be mobile."
"Go for it, Tilly,"
Flynn said. She looked at Poe, then added,
"Just don't tell your mother."
For 20 minutes, Poe demonstrated how to drive the quad. Other than computer games, Bradshaw had no driving experience whatsoever, but it was easy, and she'd picked it up quickly. He showed her how to turn it on and off, how to disengage the brake, and how to put it into drive. The throttle was on the right-hand grip, and the rest, he explained, was a case of not getting stuck. Bradshaw laughed and smiled the whole way through. After 5 minutes of supervised riding, she was proficient enough to set off on her own. They watched her leave, as if she were their daughter going off to college.
"And mind the road!" Poe shouted.
Crossing the A6 was the only time she'd be on a road. Technically, she needed a license to cross it. He glanced at Flynn and hoped she hadn't realized. Bradshaw waved without looking back. With half the team away on tasks, and with nothing for them to do until they reported back, Flynn and Poe took Edgar for a walk. It was mid-afternoon, and it felt like they'd made some progress. The weather was the same as the day before, but somehow it seemed brighter. It was funny how mood affected the senses. Flynn asked him about Herdwick Croft and how he'd ended up living there.
"Bit of luck, really," he told her. "I wanted to buy something outright after I sold my flat, but I needed something cheap, as I assumed I'd be getting sacked. I was queuing at the council offices in Kendal, seeing if I qualified for housing support, and I happened to be standing behind this farmer. He was raging at this poor woman behind the reception desk. I calmed him down and took him for a pint. He told me that he owned large swathes of Shap Fell, the fell we're on now, and some bean counter in the council tax department had decided that, as Herdwick Croft had once been a shepherd's dwelling, albeit over 200 years ago, it was eligible for council tax, and without any discussion he'd been sent a bill through the post." Flynn turned to look at the croft in the distance.
"It's a smallish building, though. Why didn't he just pay it?"
"It might be small, but it's near Kendal, and that means it's in a high band. He couldn't even knock it down, as it's a Grade II listed building."
"So you offered to buy it?"
"Did the deal that afternoon. Paid him cash for the building and the land. 20 acres of bleak and desolate moorland. I spent a few grand on a reliable generator, hired a company to dig a borehole, and put a pump in. Another lot buried the septic tank. It gets emptied every 2 years, apparently. My only outgoings are generator fuel, gas, and my car. Comes to less than 200 quid a month."
"And now you're back in the real world."
"And now I'm back in the real world. The IPCC investigation still stands, so it may not be for too long."
Flynn said nothing. There were no reassurances she could give him, and he was grateful she didn't try to sugarcoat it. A week ago, he'd have welcomed his termination. It would have been a full stop to that part of his life. But now, with his warrant card in his pocket, he was no longer sure he was ready to quit being a police officer. It had been depressingly easy to revert to cop mode. He knew one thing for sure, though. Herdwick Croft was his home. He'd never move. He loved the land, and he loved the solitude too much. Whatever the future brought, the isolated shepherd's dwelling would remain part of it. Flynn's phone rang. She answered it, then said,
"That was Tilly. She hasn't found anything."
Damn. If Bradshaw couldn't find anything, it was unlikely Reed would. They made their way back to Herdwick Croft. They arrived at the same time as Bradshaw. The quad skidded to a halt, and she leapt off with a huge smile. She was breathless with excitement, and Poe's first thought was that she'd found something after all, until he realized it was simply the exhilaration of driving. She bounded over to Edgar, and with all the guile of a 5-year-old, slipped him a piece of meat she must have begged from the hotel kitchen. She looked at Poe with an innocent face. An hour later, Reed appeared.
"I'm going to have to get another quad," Poe thought.
Reed had walked miles that day.
"Anything?"
Flint asked.
"Nothing obvious. No suspicious deaths for years, and nothing on the system weird enough to be linked to the immolation man."
Poe could sense a but coming.
"But," Reed said, "and I'm loath to even mention this, as I was leaving the office, I gave a last shout out for anything."
"And?" Poe asked.
"And someone who lives in Shap reminded me that Tolland Man was found up here."
Poe was nonplussed. His history recollection wasn't perfect, but even he knew the 2,500-year-old mummified body of the Tolland Man had been found in Denmark, not Cumbria. It was one of the weird facts that had struck him from his school days. That, and the spinning Jenny having had something to do with the Industrial Revolution.
"Not the Tolland Man, obviously," Reed clarified. "But 12 months ago, a John Doe was found buried in a salt depot up here. Although the salt had dried him out to no more than a husk, he was perfectly preserved. The cops who worked on it gave him the nickname, and it stuck. Total fuck-up from start to finish. The guy in the JCB had scooped him up in the bucket, panicked when his workmate saw a hand sticking out, dumped the full load on his mate, who died of a heart attack."
Poe hadn't heard of it. But then again, why would he? He'd been little more than a hermit for the last year and a half.
Who was he? He was never identified. There were no obvious injuries, and the pathologist thought the cause of death was probably natural. The prevailing theory is that he collapsed while trying to steal salt for his drive. A lot of that used to go on when the council stored salt and grit outside, and neither died immediately or froze to death. The body gets covered with snow, and then the digger doesn't notice him when he's loading the lorry.
Surely it'd have clogged up the gritter, though.
Not necessarily. He was found in the Hardendale salt store, that stupid-looking one at Junction 39 on the M6.
Poe knew it well. It was only a few miles from Herdwick Croft. It was dome-shaped, and he'd assumed it was some sort of air defence installation when it first went up. He remembered feeling disappointed when he discovered its more mundane purpose. Reed continued.
"Anyway, Highways England have a contract with the council to keep it fully stocked. When the council closed some of their smaller depots, most of the salt was transferred to Hardendale. It's likely Tolland Man was stealing salt from one of the smaller outside depots when he died and was simply transported to Hardendale in the back of a council truck. If it hadn't been for the brutal winter we've just had, it's unlikely the salt would have been depleted low enough for him to be found."
"And it was definitely natural causes?" Flint asked.
"That's what the pathologist said."
"And the man who died at the scene?"
"A walking heart attack, apparently. The dickhead driving the JCB resigned before he could be sacked, but there was never any suspicion of foul play."
"Why was the body never identified? Surely someone must have missed him."
"He had nothing on him, and because of the salt, the pathologist couldn't be sure how long he'd been dead," Reed replied.
He removed a notebook from his inside pocket.
"The official report is that he'd probably been in his early 40s when he died, but that could have been years ago."
"And missing persons was nowhere near as sophisticated back then," Poe said.
"Exactly."
Bradshaw had been busy on her computer for a change. Despite Tolland Man being seemingly irrelevant, she'd taken it personally that her beloved internet had let her down.
Poe heard the printer she'd set up whir into action. She collected the information and passed them a sheet each. It was an article in the Westmorland Gazette entitled, "Man Dies After Unidentified Body Found in Hardendale Salt Store." It was a summary of what the press knew. It was less than Reed had told them, and mostly conjecture. They read in silence. Poe got to the pathologist's report. It said that, for the unidentified man to become as desiccated as he had been, he had to have been buried in salt for at least 3 years, and the clothes he was wearing meant he couldn't have been there for more than 30. The jacket he'd been wearing had only been available since the mid-1980s. But Poe wasn't buying such a vague time of death, not in the context of where they were and what was happening, not when you considered one other factor.
"It's him," he said.
This is who the immolation man is pointing us towards. His statement was greeted by silence.
Go on, Flynn said.
The jacket he was wearing, Poe explained. It wasn't an expensive one. Certainly not one you'd wear for years and years. Flynn nodded. It indicates he'd been dead closer to 30 years rather than 3. Agreed? Again, Flynn nodded.
Maybe. But so what?
Yeah, Poe. Share what you've got with the rest of the class, Reed said.
I'll tell you why it's important, boss, Poe replied. If this so-called Tollan man was alive today, he'd be in the same age group as the rest of the immolation man's victims.
Chapter 16 Nah, I'm not buying it, Poe, Reed said. It's a coincidence. He looked round for support. How can it not be?
I agree with Sergeant Reed, said Flynn. I can't see how this is relevant, Poe, even if you're right about the date, and that involves a whole lot of guesswork. Don't forget, he died of natural causes.
Poe, who begrudged coincidences at the best of times, wasn't prepared to dismiss it so easily. It was Shap, population 1200. Nothing ever happened in Shap. The percontation point had to be alluding to Tolland Man. At the very least, it merited further investigation. Loose ends and unexplained details bothered him more than they should.
Fair point, he conceded. But as we've got nothing else to go on, we may as well tug on this thread for a while. See where it takes us. Agreed?
Flynn nodded, but Poe could tell she still wasn't convinced.
We'll look into it, but I don't want us ignoring everything else.
What do you need from me? Reed asked, standing up and stretching.
I can root out the file. It'll be on the system somewhere.
Take the quad to your car, Killian, Poe said.
After Reed had left again, Bradshaw opened up her laptop, but didn't start typing.
Please may I check the MPB database, Poe?
Shit, I'd forgotten about that, Tilly, he replied.
You crack on. When the National Crime Agency was established in 2013, one of the agencies it subsumed was the UK Missing Persons Bureau, the point of contact for all missing person and unidentified body investigations. Tolland Man would be registered with them.
How long, Tilly?
With 15 unidentified bodies being recorded each month, and over 1,000 on the database at any one time, finding him might take time. Each body was assigned an ID number, and basic details to help identification were publicly available.
Found him, Poe, she replied. Case number 16-004528. I'll print off a hard copy.
The printer spat out a 2-page document. Bradshaw handed it to Poe. There was no photograph. A lot of the cases listed didn't have images.
A significant percentage of suicide by trains would never be identified. Their bodies were unrecognizable, and even more were washed up on beaches, having been exposed to the elements for too long. Sometimes an artist was commissioned to sketch an impression of how the corpse might have looked in life, but with Tolland Man having been desiccated, mummified, petrified, or whatever the correct term was for someone who'd been stored in salt for years, he doubted there'd have been value in either putting his photo on the site or trying to guess what he'd look like before every bit of moisture was sucked from his body. Most of what the document said, Poe already knew from the newspaper article. Usually the site would list details like approximate age, height, build, and an estimated date of death. The page he was holding had unknown listed beside every one of those identifiers. Hair color was listed as brown. What he was wearing was listed, but it was unremarkable. Certainly nothing that would make someone jump and shout, "That's old Jim, that is. He used to wear a top hat and a green cape." No possessions were listed. Bradshaw locked into the database and brought up the non-public information, but it didn't add much value. There was a photograph on the NCA-only part of the site, but it looked more like a prop from a horror movie than a human being. Poe wasn't expecting to recognize him. "At some point we're going to need to see the body," Poe said.
Flynn looked at him. Poe shrugged.
"We might not have a choice.
If this is linked, then it probably wasn't an accident. We'll need to put it through one of those machines of yours, find out what really happened.
The MSCT?
That's the one.
Do you have any idea how expensive that test is? Flynn asked.
Poe knew he should. It wasn't that long ago he'd managed the unit that commissioned them. He shook his head.
We have to book time with the hospital, and, by law, they can't bump a living patient for a dead one. The consultant, radiographer, and any number of other medical staff are all paid overtime. At night.
Poe wasn't concerned about the cost. He'd fund it himself if he had to.
It costs about 20 grand, she said.
Maybe not.
And I'm not blowing our entire diagnostic budget on a whim.
It's hardly a whim, Poe muttered. It has to be connected. To be fair to Flynn, even he thought he sounded desperate.
Aren't you the one who used to bang on about knowing the difference between facts, opinions and guesses? She snapped. This is a guess, Poe, nothing more, and I can't waste money on guesses.
He felt like saying, never quote me to me, but held his tongue. He knew part of the DI's job was curbing the enthusiasm of some staff, but the age Tolland man would be now was too much for him to dismiss. We're supposed to do what's right, not what's easy, he said.
What did you just say? She snarled.
Poe knew there were times when backing down was the right move. He also knew that sometimes shutting up was even better. They were still glowering at each other when Reed returned. He picked up on the atmosphere immediately. What's up?
Nothing, Flynn barked.
Just a small disagreement, Poe said. Reed was shameless in the way he couldn't be embarrassed. He retrieved the file from his rucksack and put it on the table. I've not had time to read it. Flynn made no move to take it. Poe picked it up and read the summary. There were photographs of the body in situ. He'd study them later. The last few pages were chronological entries of the actions taken. The superintendent from Kendall had signed off the case. The final entry was dated less than a month ago.
Bollocks.
Flynn, despite herself, asked, What is it? Poe ignored her and directed a question at Reed. I thought Cumbria's protocol was for unidentified bodies to be kept for a year before being disposed of. It was. It's just been changed. They're kept for 18 months, if they're to be cremated, 9 months if they're going in the ground. Poe looked at Flynn.
No fucking way, she exploded.
It's the only way we can be sure, Poe countered.
Sure of what, you idiot? Even if I felt like throwing away my career, the coroner declared it death by natural causes, and it's their fucking office that authorizes exhumations. What, you think we can waltz in there and tell them they were wrong because Tolland Man would have been an old man by now? They deal with facts, Poe, not lunatic conspiracy theories.
We need one, Poe persisted.
We don't fucking need one, she barked. And we're not asking for one, so put that idea out of your mind right now. I will not embarrass the agency by applying for an exhumation order we almost certainly won't get and don't need. And that's final.
Poe expressed his frustration with silence. She was right. Unless DCS Gamble was prepared to link the two cases and apply for it himself, and there was nothing in the way he ran investigations that suggested he'd even entertain the idea, they'd never get permission. Forensic exhumation orders were rarely applied for. The police and the pathologist were expected to do their jobs properly the first time around. Yet, he knew there had to be a link. His name hadn't appeared on the chest of Michael James by accident. Someone was drip-feeding him information, and he wasn't prepared to give up on the latest offering just yet. He'd concede for now, but when they ran into a dead end, he'd have another go. Eventually, she'd see reason. He returned to the file and reread the summary. Some kid whose dad had wangled a job for him with the council had panicked when they'd found the body in the machine's bucket, and instead of lowering it to the ground, he'd dumped it all over his colleague, Mr. Derek Bailiff. Bailiff had suffered a stress-induced heart attack and died at the scene.
I want permission to speak to the witness, then, he told Flynn.
What witness? She asked.
Francis Sharples, the one who accidentally killed his mate when they found the body. If I can't examine the corpse, at least let me have a word with someone who saw it. There might be something that seemed irrelevant then, but doesn't now.
Poe pressed his advantage.
Come on, Steph. Part of being the boss is knowing when to compromise.
Fine, she said eventually. But I'm coming with you.
Chapter 17 Bradshaw was happy to keep working at Herdwick Croft, so Poe didn't have to dump Edgar with his neighbour. She promised she wouldn't give him too many treats. Poe left out a handful, but hid the rest. Edgar had begging down to an art form, and Bradshaw had already proved to be a pushover. Reed texted Poe the address for Sharples. Since the incident at the Hardendale salt store, he'd moved out of his parents' house and into a flat in Carlisle. What he did for a living was anyone's guess. Poe knew where he was going, and Flynn didn't, so they took his car. They were soon speeding along the A6. A few miles later, they were at the turn-off for the M6, but instead of entering the northbound traffic, Poe drove over the motorway bridge and stopped beside a wrought-iron gate. He turned off the engine and said,
"That's the Hardendale salt store. That's where the so-called Tolland man was found."
They got out of the car and wandered up to the depot. It was only a stone's throw from the motorway. From the outside, the domed building looked like a planetarium or a modern concert hall. Tens of thousands of motorists passed it every day, wondering what it was. The metal gates were locked. Poe doubted it was open much during the warmer months, but the small detour had served a purpose. The journey had taken less than 10 minutes, and it emphasized, in his opinion at least, the possible link between himself and the body.
"And back there," he said, pointing the way they'd come, "is where I live. As the crow flies, it's less than 8 miles.
Flynn didn't see it that way.
"It doesn't mean anything, Poe. As D.S. Reed said, this depot almost certainly wasn't the one he died in."
Poe said nothing. 40 minutes later, Poe pulled up outside Francis Sharples's flat. It was in a converted townhouse in affluent Stanwicks, an area that was all delis and bouncerless pubs.
"North of the river," Poe said. "Very posh."
"Is it?" Flynn asked.
"For Carlisle, yes. The city doesn't have the wealth of the towns and villages in the Eden Valley or the National Park, but most areas aren't too bad."
She shielded her eyes and craned her neck to look at the house.
"What do you think Sharples does for a living?"
"God knows. He's a philosophy graduate. I'm assuming he's on the dole."
She smiled and pressed the button on the intercom with the typed name Sharples. Poe noticed that B. Phil had been added in biro. A tinny voice answered,
"Yeah?"
They looked at each other. Flynn rolled her eyes. She leaned in and in her clear voice said,
"National Crime Agency, Mr. Sharples. We'd like a word, please."
There was a significant pause. There always was after they announced themselves. They might not have the status of the FBI, their American equivalents, but their name was still enough to spook people. Eventually, the door clicked open. Sharples's flat was on the top floor, and he was waiting by the door. He was a tall and stringy man. He didn't ask for their ID, but they showed him anyway. He turned around without glancing at them. They followed him in. The townhouse might have been Georgian, but the interior was all 21st century. The large living room had polished oak floors. Modern pictures hung on the whitewashed walls. A large desk with an Apple laptop dominated the window wall. A bookcase displayed a selection of highbrow books, Tolstoy's War and Peace, Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, an old English edition of Beowulf. None of the spines were creased, and Poe instinctively knew they were for show only. He offered them his hand.
"My friends call me Frankie."
This time it was Poe's turn to roll his eyes. He made sure Sharples saw. After inspecting the rest of the room, Poe said,
"Can I ask what you were doing when we knocked?"
"I was working," he said.
Poe doubted it. The laptop was in sleep mode, and he noticed the Blu-ray player was powered up. The case for a Transformers Blu-ray was open,
and there was a cup of coffee on the table in front of the large TV. Poe didn't wait to be asked. He sat down on the nut-brown leather sofa. Sharples tried to give him the evil eye. He was a strange-looking man. A pubic beard covered his chin, and his moustache could have been made of eyelashes. His Adam's apple was so big it looked like he'd swallowed a triangle. His thinning hair was tied back into a ponytail. He wore shorts, a T-shirt, and leather sandals. A black tattoo was just visible on the bone behind his ear.
How had a grade-A dickhead like this ever worked for the council's road department?
Nothing Poe had seen fitted with him ever having had a manual job. Flynn explained why they were there, and Sharples stiffened. The memory appeared fresh. He touched his ear when Flynn asked him if he knew anything that might be of help to them. Poe looked closer and saw he was running his fingers over his tattoo. He continued touching it while he recounted the sequence of events at the Hardendale salt store. He admitted releasing the JCB load instead of lowering the bucket. Derek Bailiff had been his friend and mentor. That he'd caused his death had devastated him. And, no, he couldn't remember anything useful about the body that he hadn't already told the police. He hadn't seen much of it. It was just the hand sticking out initially, and even when he'd mistakenly tipped the load on top of Bailiff, most of the corpse had stayed buried. He hadn't been there when the body had been taken away. He'd resigned before he was fired. It was clear that he'd told the story many times. He didn't need to pause while he remembered details. It sounded rehearsed, and Poe couldn't help feeling that Sharples was leaving something out. He knew witnesses frequently did this. They tried to present themselves in the best possible light, and a peacock like Sharples even more so. He needed to put him off his stump speech.
"What's with the ink, Mr. Sharples?"
Poe would rather eat petrol station sushi than call someone Frankie. Sharples turned so they could see it. Flynn leaned forward.
"Looks like a circle." "It's an Ouroboros. A snake, eating its own tail. Symbolizes the cyclicality of life. It means..."
"I know what it means," Poe cut in.
"I had it done after the incident. It's a private reminder of the fragile nature of life."
"I wish I could remember what my personal philosophy was," Poe muttered.
He needed to take him away from the Francis Sharples Appreciation Society. Needed to needle him, get him talking without thinking.
"And it's a private reminder, my arse. You have it behind your ear so people will ask about it. You love talking about what happened. Probably the most exciting thing that's ever happened to you."
"No."
"Don't let him settle. Keep him on his toes." "What do you do, Mr. Sharples?"
"I told you. I was working."
"No. What do you do for a living? What is your profession?"
"I'm an author. I'm writing about how philosophy's increasing in relevance in a shrinking world."
"Published?"
"Not yet. But I've had some very promising responses to my proposals."
"May I see them?"
"See what?"
"Letters from publishers and agents."
"You clearly don't understand the publishing industry, Sergeant Poe. It's all done verbally these days."
"Yep, you're talking shit," Poe said.
Before Sharples could protest, or Flynn could intervene, he asked,
"What aren't you telling us?"
Sharples paled and glanced at Flynn. Her eyes bore into him.
"Nothing,"
he stuttered.
"How long have you lived here?"
"About 3 months," he replied.
"And before then?"
"I lived at home."
"So what aren't you telling us?" Poe asked. "You know we'll find out."
Sharples stood firm. Poe suspected there was a risk-reward thing going on, and without a stick to beat him, and with no carrot to tempt him, he had no reason to say anything. He was an overeducated dickhead, though. Poe reckoned another half hour would probably crack it. Unfortunately, Sharples thought that too. He stood and said,
"I'm sorry I wasn't able to help, but I really must be getting on."
Poe remained seated, but Flynn thanked him and waited for her colleague.
"I could have had him," he said as they walked down the stairs.
"Possibly. The reality is, he isn't a suspect. Just because pseudo-intellectuals rub you up the wrong way doesn't mean they're hiding something from you."
Poe had no response.
She was right. Sharples had pressed all his buttons. "Come on," she said. "Let's call it a day." Poe would have offered to take her out for an Indian meal in Carlisle, but he just wanted to get home. He had some thinking to do. He knew they were stagnating. The immolation man was too clever and too well organized to be caught by a rigid adherence to the murder manual. But the murder manual and predictable investigation strategies were all Gamble and Flynn had. He had to change that somehow. Chapter 18
Poe arrived at Herdwick Croft to find Bradshaw immersed in her computer. Edgar was curled at her feet, snoring like a fat man. She found nothing more on Tolland Man. He was sure that she'd have been quite happy to continue working, but insisted on driving her to the hotel. He'd have quite liked the company, but he needed to think. When he returned to the Croft, he whistled for Edgar and set off on a long walk, the best way he knew of clearing his head. He walked hard until he'd built up a bit of a sweat, then slowed and settled into a pace he could keep for hours. He reckoned he had another 2 hours of sunlight. He found a flattish stone on a rocky outcrop and sat down. Pulling a pork pie from his pocket, he broke it into two equal pieces. He nibbled at one, the other he passed to Edgar. It was gone in less than a second. He was in an area he knew well. His thinking zone, he called it. It was a part of the fell where two boundary walls met. Two different craftsmen had worked on them because the difference in style was stark, although both were equally impressive and beautiful. He stared at the wall he was facing and allowed his mind to focus on it. Dry stone walls, being made without any form of binding agent, were basically large-scale three-dimensional jigsaw puzzles. Two walls, with smaller stones filling the gap in the middle. Poe reflected on how much they resembled the two facets of solving complex murders. One side was Gamble and Flynn methodically building their case stone by stone, carefully and thoughtfully. And on the other side were officers like him and Reed, more instinctive, throwing stones into gaps, twisting them until they fitted, trying different ideas. And although Poe knew that his side of the wall would collapse without the one Flynn and Gamble were building, he also knew that without his side, certain cases were never solved. And there was another similarity before Poe would have to admit he was stretching the analogy too far, and that was the through stones, stones that went through both walls, locking them together. And it was a through stone that Poe was looking for. One bit of evidence that connected both sides of the investigation. He was convinced the body in the salt store was one of those stones. He either had to find a way to look at it somehow, or he had to be allowed a proper go at Sharples. If he couldn't, the Shap lead was at a dead end. He would be out of options. Unless... The thought had first occurred to him as he was driving back from Carlisle with Flynn. In the red mist of a lying witness and an awkward boss, it had seemed the logical thing to do. In the cooling evening air, it seemed anything but. He knew some people thought his reputation for following the evidence wherever it took him was because he felt he held some sort of moral high ground, that he had a calling to a purer version of the truth that was unattainable to other, lesser cops. The truth was simpler. If he thought he was right, the self-destructive element to his personality took over. It frequently allowed the devil on his shoulder to shout down his better angel. And at the minute, the angel couldn't get a word in edgeways. His face turned to granite. If he didn't do it, who would? Sometimes someone had to step up, do the unpalatable so others didn't have to. He reached into his pocket, made sure his mobile had a signal, and dialed a number. Reed answered on the third ring.
"Killian, I need you to do me a favor, and you can't mention this to anyone."
Chapter 19 Poe made his way back to Herdwick Croft. He got another pie, split it with Edgar again, and then sat down to wait. It didn't take long. Half an hour later, Reed called him. He had what Poe needed, and he told Reed why he wanted it. He made a note, thanked him, and hung up.
Leaving the BlackBerry on, he scrolled down until he found Van Zyl's number. He tossed up a few scenarios and came down on the side.